Martin said. I'm Brendan Kidwell. I'm a web developer. I've been working as a web developer for the past 10 years or so, mostly for the same company, which is pretty good. And I'm always tinkering with my stuff at home, building stuff, installing apps that I want to play around with. So I'm one of those tinkerer people. I start a lot of projects. I don't always finish everything that I start. And like, for instance, this talk right now, I just barely got it done on time. I figured out how to install OwnCloud and Subsonic. I don't even know if I'm going to actually use them, but I wanted to be able to understand them well enough to say that if these are the applications that you can use, that, you know, here's how you can use them, they're not that hard. So we're talking about today cloud storage, and there's a nice picture of clouds that I grabbed from Wikipedia. Everybody, of course, knows what cloud storage is, right? Does anybody not understand the term cloud storage? Can anybody give an exact definition that no one's going to argue with?
It's stuff you put up there.
Time sharing.
It's stuff you put up in the cloud.
Time sharing. Yeah. That's VMS.
Yeah, it's the same old stuff.
We're back to that. Yes, we are.
It's the same old stuff that they've always been selling since the 60s, just with different labels.
Terminal and mainframe. That's all.
The kind of cloud storage that we're talking about tonight is the things like Dropbox and SugarSync. And I'm sure everybody's familiar with Dropbox. The idea is you go to Dropbox, you set up a personal account, and you upload your files there, and then you can synchronize all the different computers that you have to that one Dropbox account. Every time you change a file, it pushes the files to all the other computers as soon as they're online. And Dropbox is really cool, and it's got some problems, though. There's some things come to mind right away are there's limits on how much you can store. The free account is, 2 gigabytes, or is it 10 now? I forget. And you can pay and you can get more storage. But even if you like using Dropbox, if you've got a lot of stuff, you might, like if you're a photographer, you might run into a problem where just the bandwidth that's available wherever your computers are might be a limiting factor in using Dropbox, because just the act of synchronizing over the internet might be a problem for you. And then there's some other tools that are kind of roll your own. Two that I know of are SparkleShare and Git Annex. And these are tools where you can set them up on your own server. It's all open source software. And they basically run on top of Git, which is a version control system. And I tried to get SparkleShare working, and I couldn't get the Android client to work, and I kind of gave up on it. It's not really ready for prime time or ready for the typical home user that just wants to share files with himself or share files with his family. We're going to talk about OwnCloud and Subsonic, and I'll introduce those in a minute. One of the critical things about services like Dropbox and SugarSync and all these cloud services, Google, Facebook, and all that, one of the critical things I wanted to talk about and point out, if you hadn't thought of it already, is sometimes the cloud can be a little bit leaky. And there's a picture of rain from Wikipedia.
Oh.
Specifically, one of the worst things that I heard about, this was a couple of years back, I think. Where's the date on this article? June 2011, the headline says, Dropbox accidentally unlocks all accounts for 4 hours. So for 4 hours in 2011 in June, if you happen to notice this problem, you could go in and download anybody's data. And the essential problem here is that you're trusting a third-party vendor, in this case Dropbox, that is more interested in gathering marketing intelligence than it is in keeping your data secure. And you might pay them and you might have a contract, but the contract probably didn't say anything very useful about actually protecting your data and keeping it safe. So one motivation for following this guide that I'm going to give you might be just, I want to build my own thing and I want to be in control of it myself. And fortunately, there's open source software that lets you do that. So
what kind of, I'm just curious, what kind of authentication does it have? Should I be asking later?
Yeah, we'll get into it later.
Okay.
We'll come back to that question later. So this project that I'm going to outline in this guide is we're going to set up a web server, and this can be a web server in your house. It could actually, if you want, it could be a web server in some storage cloud place like Amazon, where you still have to trust the vendor not to compromise your entire machine. But at least if you're using something like Amazon EC2 and building your own personal server, you control the software, and there's a certain level of comfort there. But I'm going to focus on the example of building your own server in your house, where you've got like a spare computer and you've set it up in a closet or in the corner of your living room. And this project is going to provide a web interface to let you upload and browse and download your files. It's going to have a web dev interface to let you mount the file storage directly on your desktop. And if you use Nautilus or Dolphin, they have commands built into them for mounting web dev shares. OwnCloud also has an API for syncing, and I'm not sure what else the API does, but they provide the API. They also provide a client that lets you synchronize Dropbox style, where you identify this folder that you want to share across all your machines, and OwnCloud takes care of it for you. And using Subsonic, we're going to set up a interface to browse your audio and video files, and also Subsonic allows you to stream it directly in the browser, as long as it's a file that's compatible with Subsonic. So that's the basic goal here for this how-to I'm going to work through. And here's the data flow architecture. I'm showing a diagram. And from the left to the right, starting on the left, we have our clients. They can be a desktop or a laptop or a smartphone that's on the same network. And they all connect to, I'm going to use Nginx as the web server, and we'll get into more details about that later. Then Nginx will forward whatever the commands are down to the two different applications we're running, OwnCloud, which is a PHP application, and Subsonic, which is a Java application. And OwnCloud is storing files directly on the file system, and then it also stores metadata for those files in a MySQL database. And inside of Subsonic, the media application, we're going to point it to a couple of the folders within OwnCloud and say, this is the audio folder, this is the video folder, and Subsonic will do its thing and index all those files and give you a nice pretty interface for the media files. So, prerequisites. You're going to need, I'm going to say intermediate Linux skills, but if you're a complete newbie and you want to do this, get started, and if you get stuck, feel free to email me. I can't guarantee I'll respond right away, but this is well worth trying if it's something you're interested in. There's lots of resources out there for getting yourself up to speed with building your own personal machines. Just a couple of URLs I put in here, ubuntuguide.org and ubuntu-manual.org. Since we're using Ubuntu Linux as the operating system, that's why I gave those links.
That's your recommendation?
It's my favorite operating system for this kind of thing. If you're familiar with Fedora or anything else, any of the BSDs, the commands aren't going to be the same, but the basic idea and what's connecting to what is the same. So if you're comfortable with it, go use whatever software you want. And in fact, I'm pretty sure you could do this whole thing in Windows. Somebody mentioned they have a Windows home server. We're using PHP, MySQL, Java, ImageMagick, a couple of libraries, and all of this can be installed in Windows, if you know what you're doing. I'm not a big fan of running PHP in Windows myself, but people do it. Got a question?
Good. Nginx in Windows? Not available.
Oh, it's not? Yeah, but you don't need to use Nginx. You can use any web server. Yeah, and this data flow diagram is just like, if you're using Ubuntu, I recommend you use Nginx for a web server. But anything that you could run a PHP app and a Java app on, you're fine. You don't need Nginx.
What was the question? Why is better Nginx? Why would you recommend Nginx than Apache?
Basically, just the learning curve of learning how to manage these servers' configuration files. I've been a web developer for quite a while, and I've learned enough Apache to install apps and, you know, maintain things, but I'm not happy with Apache. The manual is kind of hard to follow, and it seems like just every time I go and edit a config file in Apache, I've got to look stuff up in the manual, even though I was there just last week. I find that the configuration file layout and the syntax is much easier with Nginx. And Nginx has other advantages. It doesn't use a lot of memory. It's really fast. People will make all kinds of arguments for big so-called web-scale applications, and you want to use something like Nginx. But obviously that doesn't apply here because this machine is not going to have a lot of users. But I just find that Nginx is easier to understand. What about postfix?
That's easier to use than sendmail.
Does anybody still use sendmail?
I'm sure somebody.
Sendmail is so easy to
break.
You can configure sendmail and think that you did it right, and you did it horribly wrong, and you don't find out for months. And you don't find out that you're accidentally spooling to some partition that you didn't even use. And
everybody knows that XSend is the one true
sendmail. Oh, of course.
I think your mailer's got to be Turing complete. So.
You can say that XML send mail too, because it has that alias. Inside send mail.
No worries. This is informal. Feel free to interrupt or shout out or heckle me or whatever. Your machine that you're using to build this project, I say it's going to need 384 megabytes of memory. That's probably about the bare minimum that you could do, and it probably would be comfortable enough if the machine's not doing anything else. But you'll see guys that say the minimal memory for an Ubuntu server is 1 gig or 2 gigs. You don't really need that much if you're running a small application without a lot of users. So the reason I'm saying 384 is if you've got an old machine that's just kind of kicking around, not doing anything, if it runs, you can use it to do this project.
Yeah, the official server recommendation is 256, but it'll run once a week.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a Java application, so we need a few megabytes for that. And I mentioned Ubuntu. For this guide, I'm using Elubuntu, which is, it's Ubuntu server with Ubuntu server is basically Ubuntu without a desktop. Elubuntu is all of that Unity stuff removed, and they put in the LXDE desktop, which is really small, really lightweight. And if you're not comfortable running a command line only server, if you need your graphical interface, I would recommend Elubuntu. And in fact, when we go through this guide and we're editing users and stuff, I tend to do that in the graphical interface just because I never properly learned the command line way to do it.
It's Lubuntu.
Lubuntu?
Okay. Yeah, Lubuntu.
Okay. You need a network connection, and you need a lot of time. If you're an expert, you could probably do this in about 4 hours. If you're not, you could probably spend a weekend doing it. And I spent the last week or so writing the article and figuring out how the software works. Okay, so diving right into setup. I'm not going to go through step by step like a recipe and say do this, do this, do this, because that's not really productive. I'm going to try to give you the highlights of some things that I did. You can follow along in the article if you've got a computer if you want.
So it's in the article.
Yeah, it don't write down any notes here. Anything I say, unless it's off script, is in the article. So follow along and shout out questions if you got questions. So the first thing you're going to want to do, I'm assuming you've already installed the operating system. You've got a server box running in the corner of your room. You got a monitor and keyboard connected to it. First thing you want to do is make sure that other computers on the network can connect to this computer. And you need to know the IP address of the machine. And specifically, it helps to configure the machine with a static IP address. Normally, a computer on a Wi-Fi or a home Ethernet network is going to go out to the router and say, hey, I'm coming online, I need an IP address. And the router just picks one out of a pool and says, okay, you're going to be 103. And that doesn't work for servers because you're going to have bookmarks in your browser and configurations on your desktop. where you want to put in an actual definitive name for the server. And we'll actually get to the name later, but you need an IP address first. So this is a quick and dirty procedure for setting up a static IP address. It's not technically correct, but it should work for most people. If you know what you're doing, or if you want to read up on the technical details, go read those manuals I mentioned, and you can figure it out. But quick and dirty rule of thumb. You go to the command prompt, you type nm-tool, and it's going to print out this table of all the properties of your network connection. And the four interesting things that you want here are address, prefix, gateway, and DNS. And then we're going to go to Lubuntu desktop. You're going to go to preferences and then networking, and then select the network host that you want to edit, and go to edit that host. And then you're going to go to the IPv4 settings tab, and you're going to fill in those four things, except that you're going to change the address to a static address that I'm just going to pick it arbitrarily. And that's why I say this is quick and dirty. And if you're familiar with your router's configuration, you can do it the right way and say, actually assign it to this MAC address and stuff. But just quick rule of thumb, most routers will assign dynamic addresses with their end between 100 and 200 or 100 and 250. So you can just pick the address and say, well, the router gave me 192.168.1.103. I'm just going to change that 103 to a 50 and say, that's my static IP address. If you haven't got any other servers, that's probably available. And then you can go ahead and fill that in the address field up here in Edgehost. Say again, Dave?
Why not just set your router to give it to you that way?
Well, you can, but I'm assuming that you don't know how to configure your router.
Oh, okay.
If you do, do it the right way.
Okay.
I'm trying to be kind of quick and dirty here. And all of this stuff is suggestions. Where was I? You're going to put in the net mask is going to be the same as the number in the parentheses on the NM tool output. And then, let's see, gateway, you want to put in my example, we've got 192.168.1.1. And then you want to copy the any DNS servers that appear down here in the DNS. You're going to want to put that in. And to get these fields to be not disabled, you have to change method from DHCP to manual. And then that'll let you have a static IP address. When all that's done, you should be able to go to the command prompt and type ping 192.168.150, and it'll find it'll respond. So that's an overly long, quick and dirty explanation of static IP address. And then you're going to want a host name for the server. Now this you do on a client, the client being all the machines on the network that are going to connect to the server. In Windows, there's a different path for this file, but the path is the same. I mean, the file is the same, and it's in my how-to article. On a Linux machine, you go and edit /etc/hosts, and you just add one line, the IP address, and then a host name. And for the rest of this guide, I'm going to call the machine files. So, does that make sense for everybody? Okay. We want to run all the apps that we're going to install, well, the two apps, OwnCloud and Subsonic, we want them to run as running their own user account. So when I set up this machine, it said, who are you? And I said, Brendan Kidwell. I'm going to log in with the name Brendan. And that's my personal account for this machine. But I want the apps to run in their own separate user account because I might install other things on this machine. I might decide to connect this to a TV, and then I'm going to be logging in as Brendan to run the TV. So the server apps, they get their own space. And that's in, I think it's system preferences and then users. And you just add the name files. Make sure that you set the files user to be an administrator. That way when you're logged in as files and you're setting up all the apps, it can do admin things. I found that in Lubuntu, I'm pretty sure you have to, after you set the account type to administrator, you also have to go to this manage groups button and add files to the sudoers group. I think it's the group name sudo. That lets you run the sudo command on a command prompt.
That changes between different Ubuntu versions.
Yeah.
Sometimes the admin group and sometimes the sudoers group.
Yeah, so manage groups and add files to any of the administrator groups that you find there.
Even in regular Ubuntu, I think they disable the
Yeah.
So it's all under
Well, that's a pretty fundamental thing. I mean, there's on this machine, I found there's a group called sudo, and if I don't put the user in that group, then it can't run the sudo command, and I need that command in order to install the apps and stuff. So I'm gonna remotely log into the machine, log in as files, and then occasionally I'm gonna elevate privileges to the system stuff
right.
that's related to the install.
There's a configuration called /etc/proc/sudos,
yep.
and it contains %admin all=all and sudo all=all.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in either of those groups, or your username is root, then you get sudo.
Yeah, so it was a sudo group that I did. If you can't figure this out, look it up in the manual. So let's see, where are we? Then, because I'm going to be doing most of the setup on a separate machine, you know, a laptop or a desktop or something, you want to install OpenSSH Server. That lets you SSH into the machine across the network. So that was easy. Everybody memorize this list of packages. There's going to be a quiz in 10 minutes. This is in the how-to guide, obviously. So this is basically, I looked at all the requirements for all the different packages I'm going to install. These are all the things that you need up ahead of time. So just sudo apt-get install and then a list of packages, and that takes care of your prerequisites. The one thing that you're going to have to configure when you run this command is it's going to ask you for a root password for MySQL because you're installing MySQL Server. Make sure that you remember what password that you give. On a personal machine like this, I just use the same password for everything, but only on that machine. I use a different password when I go to another machine. Okay, so that's all the prerequisite software except for, where was I? My notes don't match my slides, isn't that great? Oh, here we go. Okay, so.
So the list of the software that you have is in your notes.
It's in the how-to guide, yeah, and on my website, that URL at the bottom of the page. You do have to configure PHP a little bit to get it to work with Nginx because Ubuntu uses Apache by default, and it doesn't really have packages to make PHP and Nginx work together. However, getting them to work together is not really that hard. Nginx wants to use a application connection protocol called FastCGI. You don't need to know what FastCGI is or why you want to use it. All you have to do is create a upstart file. Upstart is the thing that starts and stops services for you. You create an upstart file called /etc/init/php/fastcgi-files. The name is just arbitrary. You put these five lines of code in it and make sure that the very last line of this file that says exec, it's going to sudo as files, and then it's going to launch the PHP CGI executable. And that's critical because, as I said, I'm going to run all these applications as the user files. So in this upstart configuration file, I'm going to say, start up this daemon process as the user files. Once you save that file, you can just go ahead and say sudo service php fastcgi files, that's the name of the server, and then the start command, and it'll start it up. So now you've got PHP running. Then, let's see, Nginx, what am I doing here? To finish connecting PHP, that PHP FastCGI process you just created, connecting it into Nginx, you want to edit the default site under Nginx, and that's /etc/nginx/sites-available/default, and you just want to add one line to the top of the file to say, it says upstream PHP files server, and then it gives a Unix path of the FastCGI socket that we created in that upstart file on the previous page. So what this says to Nginx is whenever in an app configuration block I'm talking about an upstream connection called PHP files, it's going to use that socket. And then one other little thing, the way I like to configure Nginx is at the bottom of the server block in the Nginx configuration file, you'll see it when you do this, you just put in a line to say include apps/star.conf, and then that will let you put all your different application configuration files in separate files, and it just includes them all in here inside of the server block in Nginx. I could show you the whole default configuration file, but it's you don't really need to. You'll see it when you're doing it. I didn't actually put the whole file on my article. But if you install Nginx and look at this file, it's pretty self-explanatory. And anything you don't understand in there, just go to the Nginx manual. It's pretty well written. So that sets up PHP and Nginx. How are we doing on time?
You've got time.
Okay. Just want to make sure the BlackBerry isn't going to sleep.
We've got 20 minutes more and then we'll go for questions.
Okay. So the next thing is PHP MyAdmin. Now this is optional because if you know how to manage MySQL databases on the command prompt, you don't really need this, but I prefer to use PHP MyAdmin. PHP MyAdmin is a, I think I got a picture of it here somewhere. It's a web application to let you, to give you a control panel for MySQL. And I just find it's a lot easier to use than the command line. And getting PHP MyAdmin to work, do what it says in the how-to. You create that apps folder that I talked about on the previous page under the Nginx configuration. You create a file called phpmyadmin.conf, and that's going to be included in the default site when Nginx runs because of that include command. And then we just add this stuff here, and that magic tells Nginx how to interface with phpmyadmin, and it's ready to go. Restart the Nginx server, and you should be able to go directly to your hostname / phpmyadmin. So moving on. Now we're actually ready to install OwnCloud. First thing you want to do with OwnCloud is the default maximum transaction size in PHP is really, really small. I guess they don't want people attacking servers that haven't been configured by an expert. But you're probably going to be wanting to upload big files. So edit your PHP INI. The path is here on the screen. And you want to change two things, post max size and upload max size to, I just set 2 gigabytes. You can set it however you want. It should allow you to set a crazy high maximum and let you upload anything that will fit on the disk. Then you restart your PHP server process and PHP is configured. Next, you want to actually install OwnCloud. Now, I assume that you've already like downloaded the tar file from OwnCloud's website and extracted it to your apps folder. That's given in more detail in my how-to guide. You're going to add / Nginx apps owncloud.conf for the Nginx configuration to talk to OwnCloud, and you're going to add all these lines here. There's more stuff in here because OwnCloud has a web dev component, and it needs some fancy URL rewriting that I think I copied and pasted this from the OwnCloud site. But paste that in there. You got Nginx is all configured for OwnCloud. Then you want to go to phpMyAdmin and create your database. And in phpMyAdmin, it makes it pretty easy. If you go to the create user command, then it lets you easily create a login user and a database all in the same time in one transaction. So I gave it the database name is OwnCloud, the username is OwnCloud. The user can only log in from localhost. And I gave it a password, and then I scroll down to the bottom, and I hit go, and my database is ready. Now you're ready to actually start up OwnCloud. And you go to your browser. Remember, my host name is files. So I've got a file / OwnCloud, and it says, oh, look, I've never been configured. You need to set me up right now. So you type in the first user that's going to exist, admin or your name or whatever, type in the password. Funny thing is, it doesn't ask you to type in the password twice, so make sure that you get it right. Or else the easiest thing is just delete the database and start over. But make sure you get your password right. You could write it in Notepad and then copy and paste it in. It needs to know where the data folder is, the default's going to work. And then you go to, say the database is MySQL instead of SQLite. SQLite is not as fast as MySQL. and then you type in your MySQL database that you did in the previous step, and then OwnCloud's ready to use. And we'll get into a demo in a second. I'm just going to quickly show about Subsonic as well. Subsonic actually has a Ubuntu package that you can use. So you download that package, you run the installer for that package, and then you just have to edit a few things to make it work in this scenario. The /etc/default/subsonic file is configuration for the upstart file for Subsonic. And you want to, again, like the like I'm running PHP as the user files, I want to put into this config file, say, subsonic_user=files. That says to the Subsonic start script to run as the user files as well. Then you need to create Subsonic data folder and change the ownership to files, the user files. And then the last thing, this is kind of tricky. Because you're not running Subsonic in the root of the web server, we're actually going to be running it as files, http://files/subsonic. We need to edit the context path in the Subsonic startup script, and that's the path for that file on the slide. Once you do that, Subsonic should be all set to use. Except you've got to install the config file to connect Nginx to the Subsonic server, and that's here. Basically, Subsonic, instead of using FastCGI, it's just going to be, Nginx is going to be a proxy server for Subsonic running on port 440. So that's that. And now it's time for a demo, finally.
Before you do that,
yep.
Can you give me a link to this how-to so I can maybe try it?
Oh, I'm sorry, Dave. Go to www.glump.net and then search Glump, G-L-U-M-P.
G-L-U-M-P.
Yep, .net. And then you can go search that page for file server. Okay. So this is what OwnCloud looks like, and I realize I probably should have shown this at the beginning to keep your attention. It's got a bunch of functions listed on the left-hand side, and you can extend these functions by adding plugins. It comes with a bunch of plugins pre-installed that are, a lot of them are turned off. So you might even, they're like part of the default install, but they don't assume that you're going to want to use them, so you need to turn them on if you want them. The first function, the most important one, is files, and that's where we are now. And I pre-populated my database with a few files. We've got some audio. We've got some books here. I've got Alice in Wonderland, and I think I put a couple of Cory Doctorow books. No, just one Cory Doctorow book. Basic, here's your files, here's a browser. And it does let you view the files directly online. Like I can go into Cory Doctorow and click on this PDF file, and it has a PDF viewer built into it. And it also, I was happy to find out, has an EPUB viewer. Say again?
How does that look?
How does the PDF viewer work?
Yeah.
Just fine. You go click on the file and it opens. I don't know how it works. I don't care.
Is it Flash?
No, it's all HTML.
Oh, it's not.
Yeah.
Isn't
there a browser extension or something for PDF viewer?
There is also, yeah.
Or it's like a...
Can you just render that file once again, the PDF file?
Yeah. And I think I can copy and paste and everything. So on the server side, it's rendering it as HTML.
It should, yeah. Yeah, it should.
And Dave, if you ever install this, I'd be interested to see if this actually works with your screen reader.
What's that?
The PDF viewer built into OwnCloud. Did I say screensaver? Screen reader. I'd be interested to see if the PDF viewer works with your screen reader.
Okay. Sure. See what kind of HTML it renders it as.
Yeah. Well, it is HTML, but it's also, you know, the original PDF formatting is there. So
yeah.
This book that I'm looking at has two columns. I have no idea how it's going to work, but you can,
yeah.
if So here's an example of a plugin. If I click on this EPUB file right now, actually it does nothing. It lets me download it, but I don't want to do that. I know that there's a, because I was browsing before, there's a PDF plugin, EPUB plugin. So I'm going to go to apps. Let's see. Yeah. And here's a list of all the plugins that are installed but not necessarily turned on yet. And I'm going to go down and turn on EPUB Viewer, enable. Say that again? No, I'm doing this inside of the own cloud interface in the browser. So the EPUB Viewer that I just turned on is part of own cloud. And now I can go back to files and go to the Cory Doctor of this book, and it should open up the EPUB file.
Yeah, I mean, there we go. Viewing of EPUBs isn't that impressive because they're just HTML files inside of the zip.
Yeah.
Or a PDF, that's more impressive.
Well, yeah. But as far as, you know, I'm looking at this from the point of view of a user, right. And it gives me access to a lot of different file types as long as there's a plugin for it.
That's pretty cool.
So, okay, where else was I going with this demo? Let's see. Got to show Subsonic. So, the way I've configured Subsonic.
I have a question.
Yep.
Does it remember where you left off when you last closed off?
I'm pretty sure it does, because I think we just saw that. So I'm in the EPUB file right now, and yeah, this is where I was when I closed the file a minute ago. So the plugin and the PDF plugin did it as well. When you close an object that's being viewed in one of these plugins, the convention seems to be that the plugin remembers for each user where you were. Let's show a bit of Subsonic. So I have Subsonic running in the path Subsonic. And remember in that data flow diagram way back in the beginning of the presentation, I said that I actually placed my Subsonic audio and video folders within my own cloud data storage. So I go to the settings here and I can see home, files, apps, own cloud, data, the username, that's me, and then files / audio, and then videos is files / video. And then Subsonic will go and look at both of those files and index everything that's in there and give you a nice pretty interface. And so, like, if I wanted to play one of these videos, this is all HTML5 here. I pick this video, I hit the play button, and there it goes. And if you've ever seen this video, Adam Buxton counting, it's kind of vulgar and really funny.
Yeah.
It's not for kids.
Probably not, yeah.
Now, one tricky thing about this, and I didn't have a chance to explore this fully, but Subsonic is open source. It says it's open source. It says GPL license. And it, when you go into the video player in Subsonic, it says this feature is only available until March 8, 2013. You must donate to use it permanently.
They keep using that word. I don't think it means what they think. What
yeah.
Do you think it means?
Well, they're probably technically okay because, like, you know, here, it's GPL software. We're giving you the source code. The software is free. Now, if you want to modify your personal copy of it and remove that nag, you're welcome to do it.
Oh, no, it's not that. I mean, painted GPL is awesome, but it's just the word donate.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird thing. And I don't think you have to donate a lot and, you know, take it. And it might also be that, like, a future version, they'll actually remove that code, and then you can just go to an older version and copy and paste the old code into the current version you have today.
But I think it might have something to do with liability. If you buy something,
mm-hmm.
there's a sort of liability there.
That's how
it's
going
to work.
Mm-hmm.
True,
and
but if you buy something...
You can't set up a barrier to people downloading software. By saying, like, you can have this GPL code with the source code if you give me your email address.
Yeah.
You can set up a barrier before, and so if you say, by downloading this, you agree that you'll eventually donate if you keep it. So it's kind of a weird wiggly thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, like, technically you could just strip that part out if you felt like it.
But in reality, the amount you want to donate, it's probably just worth it to just go ahead and donate. I'm going to look right now and see what it is. Oh, did I even... I'm not on the internet. We'll do it later.
No,
you won't. No, it's going to say... oh, I am. Yeah. We suggest a donation of €20. The lowest one is 10. I hate PayPal, though. Maybe I can send them a check. I don't go anywhere near PayPal if I can avoid it.
What about Bitcoin?
Bitcoin I haven't tried yet. Just, we could spend a long time going through this whole interface, and we're not going to, but I just want to show something briefly that's, it should be obvious. You might just ask, like, does this thing actually support playlists? Like, can I run a party with this kind of thing? And it seems to. So if I go to, let's see, play all, it's going to add this entire, I'm looking at an album right now. I hit play all on there, and it added the whole album to the playlist that's down at the pane on the bottom of the screen. And you can just use it like any other media player. But the critical thing is that this entire player, the part that you're running locally on your machine, this entire player is all HTML5. So you can run this on any handheld, any laptop, as long as you have connectivity to the server. I've got a friend, Dave, that not the Dave sitting here, that uses Subsonic all the time. He's got his home server connected to the internet, and then he connects to his home server from work and plays his Subsonic files over the internet.
Now, is there any special considerations that you have to do on your router and stuff like that?
Yep, I'm going to touch on that briefly. I'm not going to show all the details, but basically you need to set up port forwarding.
You have to forward, or if you want it to be really fast and loose, you can DMZ the machine.
Yeah. Don't DMZ the machine.
Okay, but forward the ports, yeah. Sorry. But accepting traffic from the outside like that, the ISP doesn't have a problem with that?
No, people do that all the time. Pretty much all the consumer ISPs say in the terms of service, you can't set up a server. And then you go ahead and set up a server, and they don't stop you.
They don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can't tell.
Well, they could prevent inbound connections, but they only prevent inbound connections for SMTP.
Yeah.
They generally don't get in the way.
Okay. They don't seem to, though.
Because if they... What's that? Yeah, but they usually prevent inbound connections as well. They don't want you doing any SMTP. They want you talking to the mail servers over a different protocol because everybody uses SMTP to send spam directly to mail servers.
They want you to relay through them.
What's that?
They want you to relay through them or some other authenticated.
Well, the SMTP is a sticky thing because if they allow you to run your own mail server, then it's really hard for them to have any kind of spam control. Spam is completely out of control.
They could just ban Windows machines.
They could require an internet license in order to connect your machine to the internet. So that's about all of the web UI that I want to show you. But the other, you know, if you're coming here and say, what about all the Dropbox stuff?
Can you say what tools your friend uses server from the office?
Just the internet. You just set up the server. You have to know what the internet IP address of the machine is, and you can optionally set up a DNS name for the server. I use DYN DNS for that. That's not free though. But just there's no special thing to do. You just need to know the address and connect to it.
Yeah, but the address is like a 192.168.
No, I'm talking about you connect to your router over the internet. Your router connects you to the machine.
Okay.
So you need to set up port forwarding, and you need to set up access. You need to know the internet address of your router. I can't hear you in the back.
Or didn't need us.
What did you say in the back?
You need a static IP for your home internet.
You don't really need a static IP address to connect to your home router from the outside because most internet services will give you a dynamic IP address that doesn't change for weeks and sometimes years. So it's a dynamic IP address, but it's really not changing. So as long as you know what it is, you're okay. And you can use DynDNS to set up a host name, and then you can set up a DynDNS client on the machine, on the actual server, that will go and ping DynDNS and say, hey, I noticed my IP address changed, and it'll program the new one. So there's ways to handle that. You don't actually need to have a real static IP address to your router. So real quick, I want to show the syncing capability. Well, two things, the syncing and the web dev access. I'll do syncing first. The menu's not responding. OwnCloud has a sync tool built into it. I mean, the project has a sync tool. And you go to OwnCloud, you go to install, I think, and there's desktop clients. Oh, it has mobile clients too. I forgot about that. So desktop client, pick your operating system, install the client, and then what you end up getting is, looks a lot like the Dropbox client. And, okay, there's my own cloud. So it's this little thing that runs in your system tray, and it created a folder locally called OwnCloud, and that's right under my home folder. And every time I change a file in here, it gets synchronized with the client sync folder in my OwnCloud account. And the reason that the sync client creates a special folder for itself is because what if you have giant files in your file collection, like, you know, that video I was showing earlier. This one's only a few megabytes, but you might have some full-length movies in here, high def. You might not want to be syncing that to all the machines that connect to your own cloud. So anything that you do want synced to everything, you've got to go into the client sync folder, put it in there. And you can create subfolders and create as many folders as you want. The syncing client only connects to that folder. And then the other method of access from your desktop without using the web browser is you can use web dev, as I mentioned earlier. And basically just, I'm using Nautilus here. It's the same in most file managers. Connect to server, protocol is web dev, server name is files. The path in my slides, I think, is, oh no, it's in my notes. The path is /owncloud-remote.php web dev, username Brendan. Remember password and connect. Yeah, I'm using Nautilus. And there it is. So if I go to the location bar, it's the URL is dev and then the path that I just typed in. And then inside my file manager, I can just access this like any other folder on the system. And I can even open files directly from web dev. Okay, just a couple more minutes. Almost there. And so direct file access. And what else did I have? We talked a little bit about the advanced configuration. The one thing that we didn't talk about, and this is in the how-to guide, but I don't go into a lot of detail, is if you're accessing the machine over the internet, you're probably going to want to set up TLS or SSL. That's security protocol for HTTP. Most people don't know this, but you can get free SSL certificates from a company called Start SSL. That's startssl.com. So if you ever want to set up your own secure web server that uses encryption, go there, get a certificate, follow their directions, and they even have a page about how to configure it in Nginx. And now I'm at the end of my notes, and do we have any more comments, questions, criticism?
The authentication, somebody brought that up early on.
Yep. Well, the authentication happens in forms in the browser and also through the web dev protocol and the sync client. In terms of the back end, where are your usernames and passwords stored? They're stored inside of the OwnCloud database. I think OwnCloud has a plugin to use LDAP and some other protocols. I think it can chain through to another web dev server. And, you know, feel free to read the manual and explore. Did you have a particular concern or what you want to connect it to?
Basically, one of the things I was thinking about is how do I lock it down to make sure it doesn't get hacked, other people using it? Can I get access to other people and things like that?
I didn't look into the sharing and user separation part of OwnCloud, but the OwnCloud application itself is running in, you know, it's running as the user files. That belongs to the system administrator.
Yeah.
That's at the file system level. At the application level, by default, I'm pretty sure all files are private. So if you're using the OwnCloud interface and you don't have any other access to the system except OwnCloud itself, the files are marked private by default. And then you can go and edit individual folders and say, I want to share this with other users on the same system, or I want to share this with public with people that aren't logged in. So basically read the manual and see what it says there. But I'm pretty sure those capabilities are there.
I do want to add that the service that you're running, not Subsonic one, the other one.
Subsonic.
Not the other one.
OwnCloud.
There's a Juju Charm available for that if you're deploying it either in the cloud or you're using the orchestration. In,
what's available? Juju Charm?
Yeah, it allows you to basically do all what you just did by just clicking the button.
But does it integrate with Subsonic? Well, that's great. So can you post that as a comment on the meetup? Make sure that if people want an easier procedure that they can check that out too.
It's called Juju Charm.
Yeah,
it's an Ubuntu thing.
It is.
Juju Charm.
Is the link on your website already on the meetup?
Yeah, that the URL at the bottom of my slides.
Oh, no, I was just going to say I'm going to post it if anyone who wanted to come couldn't.
Yeah. So this the how-to that I keep mentioning that's longer than the slides, it's on my website. You go to www.glump.net. It's linked from the homepage. So everything I just talked about is in here. I'm going to also, I've been recording the audio on my BlackBerry, and hopefully I've got a clear recording. I'm going to add that there, put the slides as well. But really most of what you want is just read the text here. Yep.
What is your opinion about backupping our whole root system?
Can you say that again?
What do you think about backup of all the servers of the system? Do you have like any advice about backing up the system?
Oh, backup.
Yes, backup.
Backup. The way I configured it here, the simple thing to do would be to backup the OwnCloud MySQL database in the usual way. That you can find out how to back up in the manual. Basically, you run an SQL command to dump the entire database to a file, and you put that text file on your backup medium. You're all set with MySQL. And then everything else that's not the MySQL database, just the user files, /home/files, that path, back up all of that, and you're all set.
Do you have any specific tools which you would recommend?
Ubuntu has a backup tool built into it. That'll do full system backup or individual user backups.
You can just tar.
Yeah, and you can use the tar command in the command line.
I use OAuthSync with hard links.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But if you don't know what you're doing, use the Ubuntu tool for backup. I forget what it's called, but.
And Terry makes it back.
Okay, yep.
There's no limit that OwnCloud imposes on how much you can store.
It's not in the manual. There's nothing in there that says you can't store a file bigger than X. I didn't actually try, throwing something big at it, but it's basically a web dev interface to let you dump files directly to the file system. So as long as you edit the PHP and need to make sure that maximum file upload size is bigger than whatever you need, and as long as you have the space for it, there's nothing really getting in the way of storing really large files. The one thing to watch out for is don't put really giant files in your sync folder, because next time you connect your Android client, you're going to fill up the storage and everything's going to get locked up. Anybody else before we move on to the other presentation? I think we're about ready to wrap this one up.
Yep.
Okay. If you have any other questions, read the article, send me an email, and then I'll yell at you for being an idiot.
Why, thank you.
Thank you.